We are going to get started here. I noticed it was interesting getting in this morning for me, and I suspect it was going to be interesting for other folks getting in, too.
He's going to do that.
We are going to start where we left off and do our best to finish our presentation today, which means that we probably will ask for a lot more things in writing, and I hope somebody's keeping good notes.
We are.
Okay, thank you. All right, if you would like to begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Once again, my name is Leo Dodis. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and with me again today is Lyle Mueller, the agency's finance manager. What I will do is, and you do not have this, the next two slides in the original packet that we provided you, but we did provide copies of these next two slides to members of the committee, so they should be in your packets as of this morning. We've added these two slides at the request of the chair, who asked us to provide some information to the committee about what we see in terms of air days in the state, in terms of whether they're healthy or not. We do evaluate on a daily basis whether the air is healthy to breathe and issue advisories when it is not healthy to breathe. And the information in these next two slides will tell you a little bit about what the air is looking like on a daily basis in the state. Now, the charts, these next two charts, are combined for both ozone and particulate matter, and they're based upon criteria that we have that rely upon EPA guidance to determine when the air is healthy or unhealthy, or whether it's unhealthy for sensitive groups. And the unsensitive groups, or excuse me, the sensitive groups are the elderly, children, people with pre-existing conditions, and athletes. On this first slide, this just gives you a picture going back to the year 2000 of how all the days within those years break down in terms of healthy air or unhealthy air. So it just gives you an idea that for the most part, the air is has been good or moderate, but we do have some days where the air has been unhealthy or unhealthy for sensitive groups. The next slide might be a little bit more instructive, and this is, I think, important information to share with the committee because, as we discussed before, the annual trends for things such as ozone and particulate pollution are heading downward and are looking pretty good. But again, on individual days, depending on the weather conditions or emissions, we may have unhealthy air days, and those are very, very important for us to keep track of so that we can let folks know whether they need to moderate their activities. So you can see that we are seeing some unhealthy air days in the years since 2000. And just to give you an example, in the year 2005, we had 3 unhealthy days declared and 5 days where we declared that the air was unhealthy for sensitive groups.
Okay. There's a question here, and then I have a question, too. Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rodiz, can you give us a longer-term context for this, like 1980, or how many bad days we would have had at some point in the past?
Madam Chair, Representative, we don't have data that go that far back. I would say it's fair to say that going back to the 80s, we probably had more unhealthy air days for certain pollutants simply because the controls weren't as significant as they are today. But we don't have data going that far back for this particular data set.
Thank you.
If I could, Art, when I asked for the data before, are you using what air quality index are you using? Are you using the one from EPA or the one that the medical community suggested that EPA use?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the air quality index advisories are based upon guidance that EPA develops that relate to the standards that they issue. So this isn't actually measuring compliance with the federal ambient air quality standards. The AQI, the air quality index, is based upon that, but it's different. And I can't give you the scientific explanation because I couldn't actually give you that. That's beyond my technical expertise. However, the index that we're using today is lagging behind the new standards that EPA has promulgated. When they do issue their guidance, it's my expectation that it's going to rely upon the standards that they promulgated and not based upon the Clean Air Science Advisory Committee. So we'll have to take a look at that and make sure that we think it's appropriate to follow the guidance as it's written. So we'll do that when it comes to us.
The problem with following the political decision rather than the science decision is that, first of all, it's unhealthy for folks. It's also extraordinarily costly to our taxpayers and our citizens, because when we were looking at the cost of fine particulate matter, they were enormous. And my benchmark for that is when we looked at the Riverside coal plant, and just that one coal plant was costing us upwards of $60 million a year in health costs just from that. And one pollutant, fine particulate matter, in 1 year, each year. Those are costs are enormous. So to the extent that we are using a political benchmark rather than a health benchmark, we don't see the cost to Minnesotans. So it would be, I think, helpful if we looked at that and then at some point actually understood what the health costs were. I understand you all don't have the capability yet to do that, but I think that's an important thing for Minnesotans to know. It would certainly save us immense amounts of money in health care if we actually got below the health benchmarks. If you want to go on.
Okay. Now I will get back to the presentation that is in the packet that we distributed at the beginning of these hearings. What I want to talk about a little bit is some of the work that we're doing recently in trying to determine what the environmental outcomes are from the regulatory work that we do. This has traditionally been difficult for not only us but all regulatory agencies. In other words, how do we understand what the environmental impact of our actions is? And we've undertaken an effort within the last year to try to understand. You know, actually, I am going in the wrong direction. I apologize. Here we go. We're making efforts to try to understand what the environmental impact of our enforcement actions is. Typically and traditionally, over the course of the last couple of decades, regulatory agencies tend to look at things like the numbers of enforcement actions and the amount of penalties we collect. We do track that information. For the last calendar year, we've issued 115 formal enforcement actions, totaling penalties a little over $300,000. But what we do want to really get a better handle on is what the environmental impact is. And this is a graph that shows you our estimates for the last calendar year of the pounds that we believe have been prevented or eliminated or reduced as a result of our enforcement actions. I think these numbers will get better over time as we get a better sense of exactly how to calculate these. The art of this, it's probably more art than science, is getting better across the country, and we're working with folks across the country to do this better. I think that for our permitting program, you can expect that in a couple years we'll be able to do this for our regular permitting activities as well so that we can tell a better environmental story.
There's a question for you. Would Representative
Gunther? You know, I'm sorry I didn't think of this earlier, but I was around, and so was the chairperson around, when we mandated an oxygenated fuel. And prior to that, our air quality was so bad in the metro area that we had our emissions tested. Could you get us a copy of what the air quality was before we made that mandate and after that? We have the ones after that, so if you can get one before that, because I know there's other reasons we're using ethanol today, but at the time, I think the primary reason we switched to a 10% mandate was for air quality, I believe.
Yeah, if you could provide that information, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, Representative, we can do that.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to talk about two of the initiatives that we're proposing in the governor's budget. The first one is our Green Technologies Initiative. You may also have heard this is referred to as our Green Cube Initiative, and it's because it's about green fleets, green fuels, and energy. This is a request that totals $3 million over the biennium, and the focus really for most of this, $1 million of this initiative per year, is in cleaning up school buses that have older technology that don't capture enough of the diesel particulates that are coming out of the tailpipe. This initiative would allow us to retrofit 500 additional school bus engines, which we estimate would reduce exposure to particulate emissions for 30,000 children in the state. This is really what we consider a very good step forward in making sure that all the older school buses in the state are retrofitted so that we don't have any children that are riding school buses that have older technology on them. The way this program works, and this is Project Green Fleet, you have a brochure on this in your packet. is to do the retrofits funded by state dollars, but to also use that to leverage private and federal dollars to do more retrofits. Currently, we're seeing about 3 to 4 times the investment in the federal and private sectors compared to state investment to date. We expect that ratio is probably going to be about the same in the years moving forward. The other $500,000 per year for this initiative would be put into our environmental assistance grants program, which we use to fund activities that would be supporting clean fuels initiatives and clean technology initiatives, focused on E85 and biofuels in particular. The next initiative that I'd like to talk about is our ethanol mining and economic development initiative. It's a mouthful, and it probably doesn't tell the whole story, but this initiative is basically about our need to adequately fund our regulatory support activities as a result of some tremendous growth in two industries in particular, but in industry across the state in general. The first graph that I want to show you is just to give you a little context as to how we see this from our permitting program's perspective and the impacts that we anticipate we're going to see on our service levels if we're not able to get this initiative funded. The graph that you see is a graph of our permitting backlog. Backlog basically means any permit that is not considered current goes into a backlog status. We like to keep our permits current because that means the standards are up to date and we're more effectively regulating facilities. We've made tremendous progress since 2000 in reducing the backlog, particularly in our water program. We've done that in our air program as well, although we've only been tracking those data since 2004. If you look at the graph, beyond 2006 is a projection of what we think the backlog is going to look like if we're not able to get the adequate resources to do the permitting in these areas. And the reason that we're having trouble keeping up with the pace of this economic activity is that even though we've made very, very significant process improvements in our permitting programs, it's just simply a very, very large workload, which I'll talk about in a minute. Now, currently we have 23 ethanol facilities and 8 mining projects that are either in-house or are on their way to us to get permits and to do environmental review. And this is quite a bit of work. It requires a lot of staff time to be able to prepare these permits and to do an adequate job in environmental review. What we have done to date is we've already reassigned a number of staff to work specifically in the ethanol and mining industries. We've moved 16 people specifically into an ethanol sector team so that we could speed up the permits and do a better job of environmental review for ethanol plants. It's been effective. We've reduced the average time of completing our reviews for ethanol facilities from 10 months down to 7 months. Our goal is to try to get that down to 6 months, which is about what it takes Iowa to do a similar level of review. At the same time, because of these additional staff, we think we're doing a better job because people have more capacity to do a thorough job of evaluating the permits and the environmental reviews for these facilities. We've also moved 7 people into the mining sector to work specifically on those issues. Mining facilities are very, very complicated. The permits are quite technical in nature and require quite significant review. We've got a proposed facility by Minnesota Steel that is currently going through the EIS process, the Environmental Impact Statement process, and it's a very significant drain on our resources.
Excuse me, Representative Scalzi has a question.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair, and for the Assistant Commissioner. Coming from a local government's background, when we have permits, the person who is requesting the permit is covering the cost of that permit. I mean, for instance, a building permit, a furnace permit, any of those kinds of things. The person requesting the permit pays for the cost of the permit. Can you tell me why there is the initiative to seek money from the general fund rather than having the cost of the permit cover the costs and the extra staff needed to go through this permitting process?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's actually a key aspect of this initiative because, as you'll see on the slide, we're talking about only a one-time funding of this initiative so that in 2 years we would come back to the legislature with a proposal to do something along those lines. The way the system currently works is we already charge a fairly significant fee on sources once they get their permits. And those are typically the air pollution fees, and a number of sources also pay water pollution fees based upon how much they emit into the water. But those are fees that are charged once they're up and operating, and we know what their emissions are. So there's about a two-year lag from when we can collect the fees to oversee their permits when they're operating. It doesn't help us with the work that we need to do to develop the permits as they're going through construction or contemplating construction. We currently only charge $750 in fees for construction permits for these facilities. We think that what we need to do over the next 2 years is to engage in a stakeholder process with the business and municipal communities to figure out what a better fee structure is so that we can support this in a sustainable fashion in the long term.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Then is there a process then if you're asking for $3 million a year for the next, for the per year for 1 year, is that what I read this as?
Per year for the next 2 years.
2 years. Then is there a process then to return that money to the general fund after you perform your initiative and get your permitting process in place? I'm just kind of protecting the general fund here, and I'm wondering if you're going to be looking at a process to return that money to the general fund.
Madam Chair, representatives, all options are on the table for the stakeholder process. That's something that we could consider.
Tell us what it does cost for a permit. You charge $750. What is your estimated cost so we can understand what the shortfall is per permit?
Madam Chair, representatives, first I'll just sort of lay out the general philosophy that the agency has with regard to fees for facilities. We don't have a strict fee-for-service model. What we do is it has what people have called the polluter pays model. In other words, you pay an amount in fees relative to what you emit. It doesn't necessarily correlate with the level of service that you receive from the agency. As an example, Xcel Energy, I believe, is our largest fee payer in terms of our operating fees. They don't receive dollar for dollar the service that they pay for. They pay into the environmental fund to support the air quality program in general, just as an example. If we did have a strict fee-for-service model, the cost for some of these facilities could be quite significant. We estimate that for a couple of ethanol plants that we've recently permitted, that if we had billed for our services dollar for dollar, for one plant it was around $100,000, and for another plant it was around $50,000. And those costs will probably go down a little bit over time as we speed up the processes and we understand better how to do these permits and environmental reviews. But I don't think they're going to go down substantially.
Representative Doty has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ruiz, on the previous slide, you showed a significant decline in the backlog of water permits starting in 2000. Could you comment on what happened? Why did it get that much better that quickly?
Madam Chair, Representative, there was an audit that was done of the agency that was very critical of the performance of the agency in its water quality permits program. As a result of that, we undertook several subsequent process improvement activities to just really drive that down. In recent years, we've used some tools that are typically used in the private sector called Six Sigma. There are other methodologies that are out there, and we have used those to drive the backlog considerably down.
Thank you.
I think Representative Gunther and Representative McNamara.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Scalzi, I agree with the premise that they should pay the cost of permitting. However, to begin with, they were all farmer-owned and they were having a hard time financing. Generally speaking, it costs a little bit over $1 million per million gallons of output for an ethanol plant to be built, and that's borrowing a lot of money. So up front, maybe it wouldn't be a good thing, but when you look at the total impact of the ethanol industry onto the Department of Revenue, which I will get you the exact figures, it's in billions. So in a way, we're backfilling what we cost up front, and I think some of these new ones that are built by big companies maybe should pay the thing up front. They can afford to do it, but originally it was pretty tough for those people to borrow money for permitting and stuff like that. So I will get you the figures of what they bring back into the general fund, which is a very substantial amount. But certainly, the premise that you're going by, I totally agree with.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deputy Commissioner Rowdies, I'm wondering if you could get us the information specifically for Iowa and potentially a couple of the other states like Illinois or somewhere on what they're charging for the permits for both. Maybe you can check Montana on mining, a couple of states, both on mining and ethanol permits, because I was under the understanding we were doing a little bit more, you know, in line with what the permits cost. And then along that lines, do you use outside consultants to help backfill when you get a backlog like you have? And I know in the case of some of the permits and such that MPCA and Department of Commerce do, you offer the opportunity for the folks affected to speed the process up if they're willing to pay more. And I'm wondering, with the increasing cost of construction and stuff, oftentimes, if we use a little bit of private sector mentality and say, are you willing to pay for this to speed it up, allows you either to use more staff or to use outside consultants to supplement on a temporary basis.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do have the ability to do that, and we have done that and continue to do that. We contract with consultants to do some of the work, particularly on our air quality program. What we found is that in some cases it actually makes the process slower and less efficient simply because they don't have all the institutional knowledge and they're also not able to do the public part of this process very well. That's something that government is really better equipped and is probably best able to do. However, in some technical areas, we are able to contract with them to do things quicker and more expeditiously than we can do them ourselves. So we do contract in the manner that you described. The expedited permit program is something that we may look at expanding to be able to accommodate the situation that we're dealing with.
And Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. You will get us additional information. I think Representative Scalzi brings up a great point. We've taken a lot of heat for increasing the cost of fees, and I've been a big proponent to make sure that we're not using the fee income to put it back in the general fund, and here we're doing what looks like the opposite, and I don't know that we should be doing that.
Were there other questions?
Yes.
I think, Representative Anzos.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You referenced the Minnesota Steel Project.
Okay, I believe
that. Of course, that's in my district. I'm very familiar with it. First point is, of course, the resource that will be utilized here belongs to the people. Secondly, financial close on this project is probably within 4 to 6 months away, and the developers of these projects oftentimes tell us about financial close and how it's related to whether or not the project is permittable and whether or not the permits are proceeding. My first question is, could you give the committee a ballpark figure of what this private development is paying in terms of the permit process? And secondly, could you give us a snapshot of what that is looking like?
Madam Chair, Representative, I actually don't have those figures. Most of the fees that Minnesota Steel has been paying or the costs they've been paying have been through the DNR because they're the responsible government on the EIS, but we could certainly work with them to get you that information. They have not yet paid any construction fees to date that I'm aware of. Their fees, once they're up and operating, will be based upon largely their air quality emissions. Will probably be pretty significant because it's a big plant.
Madam Chair, just to follow up and just so that the department knows, I mean, my approach to this is clearly that the developer should be required to pay nearly 100% of the fees of the permitting process. I know how cumbersome this is, and I know the pressures involved in all of this. And too often, agencies such as yours don't get thanks from people like us sitting in these committees, and I know that your department as well as the DNR are just busting everything to get these permits done, so thank you.
Representative, you can ask a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Deputy Commissioner. I was glad to hear you saying that you're going to be working at trying to speed up the permitting process for ethanol plants. Obviously, we're looking at trying to develop more renewable energy here. You'd mentioned Iowa, which is our chief competitor, really, in this area, and that you're going to try to get down to 6 months in the permitting process, which is where Iowa is at currently. And just one question as far as Iowa is concerned and how we compare. Is the reason for their faster process, does it have to do with standards? Are their standards any lower than ours, or is it just the processing of the permits itself? Is it just a lack of manpower in order to get the permitting process completed? Is that the main problem that we're having in matching Iowa?
Madam Chair, Representative, I would put it into three categories, and you pretty much outlined them. The standards are a little bit different. They also have to issue federal permits for the air emissions from these facilities, and those standards or the requirements are generally the same, although they are in a different EPA region. So there probably are some differences that we don't fully understand just quite yet. There is a manpower difference, but also on a process level, they have implemented some additional process improvements that we're looking at. They use something called a Kaizen process, which is something that's been used at the Toyota and other manufacturing facilities, and it's a quick process to get you more speed in this kind of a process. So we're actually going to do that later this spring to see if it can get us down to 6 months or maybe even further. But it's a combination of factors. Their permitting and environmental review system is a little bit different in some ways, and in some cases isn't as restrictive as ours.
Thank you.
Continue.
All right, next we'll jump into the water program. And what I'll do is, as I've done for the other programmatic areas, I'll talk a little bit about the vision. I'll give you some information as we know it about the trends in the environment and also trends in our regulatory programs. And then I'll walk you through very briefly, so that we can get done in the time allotted today, I'll walk through very briefly each of the major programmatic areas to give you a sense of what it is that we do and the outcomes that we're able to achieve in those programmatic areas. The vision for the water program is pretty simple. It's that we have clean, sustainable surface and groundwater. We have devoted a little bit more attention to groundwater in recent years as a result of a return of some funding to that area, and I'll talk about that in a moment. That's a key difference for us from previous years. The key goals for us fall into three major areas, and that's in assessment, in maintenance, and then in restoration. Assessment really is about our monitoring and assessment work, where we go out and evaluate the quality of our lakes and streams and determine whether or not they are meeting our standards. The maintenance programs really fall into what falls into this category are our regulatory programs or permitting programs, where we try to maintain the quality of the lakes and streams as best we can and improve them where possible. And in restoration, this is really about our TMDL program and is the primary focus of the Clean Water Legacy Act. Now, this is a snapshot of the budget for the water program. The general fund is bigger than it has been in past biennia because in the governor's recommended budget, we are recommending an additional $21 million to fund Clean Water Legacy Act activities, and I'll talk about that in a moment. The Environmental Fund is another major area of funding for us, and this is where we fund the more the maintenance program, the stormwater program, the basin planning program, and our regular regulatory efforts. The water work is done in four major divisions in the agency. The Industrial Division is where we regulate the industrial facilities in the state that need wastewater treatment plant permits. The regional division is where we're seeing a lot of growth because this is where we do the TMDL, the total maximum daily load work in the agency. It's also where we run our feedlot program. In the municipal program, this is where we manage wastewater treatment for municipalities and individual sewage treatment systems, and it's also where we run our stormwater programs. And in the environmental analysis and outcomes division, this is where we do the water quality assessments and we also set standards, which is in a different programmatic area, and I'll be talking about in about 15 minutes. Now, a little bit about trends in water discharges. This does not speak to trends in all water discharges. This graph only tells you the story about what things look like from our major facilities in the state. Major is anything that's over 1 million gallons per day. These are pretty big facilities. We have 87 of these facilities in the state. Now, this is just to give you a sense of what things have looked like since the year 2000. We have seen a general decline in the pollution that's coming from these major facilities, and that's because we are continually improving our standards and requirements in facilities. We've also seen some innovative efforts taking place, such as the Metro plant, where they have substantially reduced their phosphorus emissions into the river. On this slide, I'd like to just talk a little bit about what we think we know about the trends in lake quality in the state. Now, if you think back to the discussion on air quality trends from the previous hearing, it's more difficult for us to speak in a very clear and decisive way about trends overall in the state when it comes to lakes and streams. The reason for this is that lakes and streams are discrete water bodies, and you can't really make general assessments about a particular region because you may have certain lakes that are very poor quality, and you can have a lake the township over that is of very good quality. So it's very difficult to make those sorts of trend statements. However, what we do do in our voluntary monitoring program is we regularly go out and assess for clarity of our lakes in the state. And the pie chart you're looking at is based upon the data that we collect from that programmatic activity. So what you can see is that for the lakes that we monitor in the volunteer program, and this is about a little over 1,000 lakes monitored throughout the state, is that we're seeing in 66% of those lakes, we're not seeing any change in transparency. And in 28% of those lakes, we're seeing improving transparency. There is a small percentage where transparency is declining. Transparency is a key indicator for us as to whether or not there's an impairment, primarily due to nutrients in lakes. What this pie chart does not tell you is whether or not the lakes in these various pie slices are meeting standards. So even in the 66% and 28% slices, many of those lakes can actually be still not meeting our standards. They're either improving or staying the same. This next slide talks about what we think we know about water quality trends in rivers. And again, this is based upon limited data and based upon data that probably don't give us the clearest sense of exactly what's going on in the lakes or in the rivers in Minnesota. These data are based upon the information we're able to collect through our Minnesota milestone sites. And this is the term that we use for the sites that we have been, we've had in place for many, many years, and is where we conduct monitoring on 80 major sites across the state. Now, the original placement of these sites, these are long-term sites, the original placement was based upon where we thought we might see problems as a result of major wastewater treatment discharges. That's not exclusively the case, but that's generally the case. So it may give us a little bit of a distorted view as to what's actually happening. We think that with the addition of the Clean Water Legacy Act funding from fiscal year 07 and what we're proposing in the next 2 years will allow us to get a better handle on trends in the rivers in the state. But this gives you a sense of what's going on. In the top few pie charts, you can see that the pollution is decreasing for the major types of pollution that you see there, which is BOD, biological oxygen demand, and total phosphorus. The reason for this is that these are what we largely control for in our major point sources. The story with the suspended solids is a little bit more mixed. We're seeing some pollution decreasing and some pollution increasing, and largely not much of a trend. Again, that doesn't speak to whether or not we're actually meeting standards. A good case in point is the Minnesota River, where we still don't meet standards for suspended solids, but the trend is moving in a positive direction. Lastly, and probably most importantly, you can see that for nitrogen, we're seeing a lot of increase in nitrogen pollution in our rivers across the state. This is a key indicator for us as it relates to non-point sources of pollution, and it's another signal to us that we do really need to step up our efforts in dealing with non-point source pollution. On to groundwater monitoring. Now, before I talk about the slide, I want to just alert you to a correction that we needed to make. As I was looking at the slide last night, I discovered that we had switched the key on the graph. So what you see on the screen is the way it should be. The slide in your packets actually has the key reversed. So if you could just make an annotation on your hard copy so that you can have that for future reference, I think that would be helpful because it's key to the story that I'm about to tell you. We have recently stepped up our efforts on groundwater monitoring as a result of the return of some funding in recent years. Back in 2001, we needed to discontinue our groundwater monitoring due to budget cuts at the agency, but we were able to start redirecting funds to this activity in 2003, and we intend to continue to do this into the future. We do two kinds of monitoring of groundwater, and we do focus largely on the shallow and vulnerable aquifers, but we do two types of monitoring. The condition monitoring that we do is basically the baseline that we're trying to establish across the state to see what the trends are in groundwater throughout all areas of the state, and we do this on a rotating basis. We have been able to reduce the level of condition monitoring we're doing from one year to the next, simply because as we get more data, we can, on a statistical basis, sample fewer aquifers and still get a good sense as to what the trends are for overall condition. Where we need to ramp up our efforts a little bit more is in our trend monitoring. Now, these trend sites are repeated at the same sites, and we do that over a long period of time. And this is very key for us to understand what the trends are at specific important sites that we need to be focused on. And we anticipate increasing resources into this area in the coming years.
What you've given us is how much work you've done. You haven't given us what you've found. And that would be helpful if, in your reporting back to us, that you would tell us some of the things that you have found. At some point, we are going to be looking at Dakota County because they have done some very, very good work. And so I think we would like to have the work you've done, too. Representative Clark.
Just a question. You said you discontinued monitoring altogether in 2001 because of budget cuts. Where are you in terms of the return of the money that you were talking about? Are you back to where you were prior to those cuts, or are you still in a deficit?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know the total figures. I don't believe we're back to where we were prior to 2001, but we can get you that information so that you can make a comparison. And on the note of the data on what's happening in the environment, the last point I wanted to mention was that we will be issuing a report soon, I believe this spring, on what we've been able to find so far, and we will be reporting every 5 years, so we will make sure that you get that data as soon as it's available. It's very soon. Next, I'd like to talk very briefly about the various activities that we do in the water quality program. This will give you a good sense of the agency's role in water quality protection and restoration in the state. As I've mentioned before, we do assessment. We also have many permitting and compliance activities that deal with things such as stormwater and wastewater pollution. And we also have a variety of non-regulatory programs that primarily deal with non-point source pollution. To give you a sense of what things are looking like in our wastewater programs, we have seen a steady increase in the number of permits that we issue in the wastewater program over the last 13 years. And it's been about a couple of percent increase per year, and it's an increase that we expect to continue as wastewater treatment plants continue to come online or implement new changes to be able to get up to date with the latest technological improvements.
Let me ask a question about your standards that you use. When is the last time you've done a complete update of your wastewater treatment standards?
Madam Chair, I'm not exactly sure. We are in the process of revising our standards at this point in time, which I think represents the most comprehensive revision in recent years. We anticipate that's going to be done this summer and fall. We're in the middle of that rulemaking process right now. And I'll actually be talking about that a little bit in the multimedia program area.
All right, well, it would be nice to know when the last time you did. You can just let us know when you respond to us.
Will do. Now, this next slide will give you a sense of what it is we're able to accomplish from our wastewater permitting program. Now, as I said, in the air quality program, I think we still have not as good a sense as to what the environmental impact of our actions is, but I think this might give you a little bit of an understanding of how we're able to control pollution coming out of wastewater treatment plants. Quite simply, this is just a graph that shows you what comes into a wastewater treatment plant and what comes out as a result of the reductions that are required in our permits. So the reductions can be quite significant. If you look at phosphorus in particular, we're able to reduce the amount of phosphorus that comes out of the wastewater treatment plant pipes compared to what comes into their plants at the beginning of the process.
Representative Gunther has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. More of a statement than a question. About 2 years ago, we changed the priority system with wastewater and drinking water. I had the Public Facilities Administration in my committee, and you worked very well with them, by the way. They really extol the virtues of your input on determining the priorities for wastewater in Minnesota. And you just changed the criteria, so we changed the list. And there was a little controversy among some towns when you did that, but you updated it at that time. So it was a significant challenge for them and us to tell a legislator, I'm sorry, you're not in the priority system anymore. So I know you updated it then.
Do you have any idea, look at the reductions from, you know, untreated to treated when you permit, but we know that we have an enormous backlog of permitting needed in Minnesota, or wastewater treatment systems needed in Minnesota. Do we have any idea, if we were to look at pollution as a whole, because we are not bonding, and that's our responsibility, because we're not bonding for wastewater treatment, do we have any idea what that impact is on our waters?
Madam Chair, we could probably get you that information. We do a regular needs survey, I believe is the name of it, that probably speaks to that to some degree. So we will look into that and get you that information.
Okay. What I know is in terms of dollars, and we will hear that we should be putting $60 to $70 million a year into bonding for wastewater, which would leverage even more funds. So the need out there is beyond enormous. But what we don't have is a sense of what kind of pollution that represents, and if treated, what it would look like.
Madam Chair, we will do what we can to provide you that information.
Thank you.
It's a great question. Now, on a process from a process perspective, I talked a little about the environmental outcomes that we get from our wastewater treatment plant permitting program. Here, I just want to give you another picture of what things look like in, from a service level perspective. We already talked about that when we discussed the ethanol mining initiative, but as you can see, we've been able to achieve pretty significant progress in reducing our backlog of permits in this program. From a compliance perspective, compliance is generally pretty good in the wastewater treatment sector. Our average overall rate is about 94%. And that's driven primarily by the compliance rate we see in the smaller facilities, of which there are many, many, many more than the major facilities. We have about 1,400 minor facilities, these are the smaller wastewater treatment plants, compared to 87 major facilities, which are over 1 million gallons per day. We do visit these facilities on a regular basis, have a pretty good understanding of what their compliance rate is, and they are required to report to us on a very regular basis on what they are discharging from their facilities. Now I'd like to talk just briefly about the stormwater permitting program. It's an area that we've seen quite a bit of change in recent years. There are three kinds of permits that we issue in the stormwater permitting program. The largest by far is our construction permitting program. And in this program, we issue about 3,000 permits per year. And this is a permit that we are required to issue by the federal government to any construction project that disturbs more than 1 acre of soil. So it's a fairly significant level of effort for us. This is a change in federal law that took place just within the last few years. Traditionally, we were required to permit facilities or construction projects that disturbed over 5 acres. So our permitting universe has gone up quite considerably. The second largest chunk of this is industrial stormwater permitting. We are in the process of revising our rules to meet new federal requirements, and we'll be doing that within the coming year. And in this area, we have about 1,800 permits that we issue. And finally, the municipal stormwater permitting program is, I think, an area that, while it's a small slice of the pie, is representing quite a bit of work for us. We are required to issue stormwater permits to the largest and medium-sized municipalities across the state. Currently, it's at 239. And for each of these permits, we need to go through an extensive public involvement process to make sure that the public is aware of, understands, and agrees with us that the permits that the cities are issuing or are receiving from us are adequate.
Representative McNamara has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for interrupting there. Madam Chair and Assistant Deputy Commissioner Rowdies, my question in regards to the stormwater outcomes, and it's probably something you need to get back to me on, I have two questions. If I'm not mistaken, the majority of these fees are probably end up being paid on municipal, county, township, state projects. So the reality is we're just increasing the cost of doing those. So I think that's important to know that that's one of the increased cost of it. And I support it. I think it's a good idea. But I think the reality is it's just coming right back on us. That's more a comment. The one question I do have, I have had a number of folks bring to my attention, and I've seen it over the years, and I'm wondering if we require the removal of silt fence and other erosion control measures after establishment. I've gone on projects that we've done where silt fence is decades old, pretty well buried in established turf and stuff, and it's got to be a real safety hazard for people, for wildlife. And I'm wondering, it just really looks bad. It doesn't degrade. It's ugly. It's a terrific product. Does a great job. But do we require the removal of it? And do you know if it is required, it seems like it's just totally not being enforced.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know the answer to that question. I've never heard that before. I think it's a great question, and we'll look into that and get back to the committee.
Before you move on to the next slide, when you have looked at the estimates of relative contributions to pollution, when we've been looking at the clean water legacy problem, construction is a huge contributor. Why don't we have our hands around that issue? I mean, why is it a huge contributor to the urban portion of our problem?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can only speculate on the information you're referring to, but I would imagine that for urban areas, a lot of that is about runoff from pre-existing development. And it's part of that is about construction. And so I'll just separate the two and talk about them independently.
It's the construction part, and I think it is large, and it's the construction part I'm interested in.
Okay. With regard to construction stormwater permitting, the permits, and I'll talk about that on the next slide in a little bit more detail, it's a best management practices-based program. What that means is that you have reasonable assurance that if a contractor on site is doing the work that they're required to do on the permit, they're going to get a certain amount of control. And it's usually in the neighborhood of about 80% if they do a really good job. What we find is that this is an industry that we still are coming to grips with how to effectively oversee. And I say oversee deliberately. It's not just about regulation. There are many, as you can see, we have 3,000 permits that we issue across the state. It's very difficult for us to visit every single site so that we ensure that everything is being done appropriately. We're working as hard as we can with our local government partners to be able to ramp up our field presence, to be able to do a better job on that. But the fact of the matter is, I think that the ultimate solution for how we finally get a handle on this still eludes us a little bit. What we do have right now is we have a steering committee that we have been working with for some time now that consists of the development community and local units of government to figure out how we can do a better job at this. Because all of us have driven by sites where you can see that there is stormwater runoff that's happening because the implementation of the DMPs is probably less than adequate. So I think it is a vexing problem. The other major portion, which you didn't ask about, but it's having to do with runoff from municipalities. A lot of the infrastructure in our older cities was not built to properly manage stormwater runoff. As a result, many of these cities are probably going to have to do some retrofitting in coming years to make sure that they get a handle on the runoff from their existing development and to even address some concerns that might be expressed in the form of a TMDL. So I think there's going to be a lot of change still in the stormwater area in coming years. A lot of it's going to be driven by the TMDL program.
I think we will want to revisit the construction issue because the size of that in the pie chart was startlingly large for something that we should be able, I mean, if that's a huge part of our the thing we have to tackle with regard to clean water legacy, then we need to tackle it.
Mm-hmm. To this point?
Yes, Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I really appreciate you bringing up this point. Historically, this has been a huge deficiency in the situation where construction was just, we said, well, we just let it go, and they piled black dirt, and there was no control around catch basins and temporary measures. I've got to commend the MPCA and MnDOT for really working on this in the last 10 years. Currently, anybody that's going to be a contractor for MnDOT has to go to stormwater. They have to be light. They have to become certified, I believe it is, in erosion control measures. MnDOT is incorporated into their bid documents temporary erosion control measures that sometimes are initiated within hours of certain situations. You have to do so much temporary control. If you're an erosion control contractor, you're very happy today because the amount of work in that part of the industry has skyrocketed, and justly so. If you'll notice, folks, when you drive by road construction now, oftentimes you'll see temporary straw, hydro mulch put on piles just of sand. We never used to think that we should cover that up, and they're doing those kind of things today, Madam Chair. I believe there's more work to do, but we have really done some great things in controlling, which really was a huge contributor to sediment and erosion in our lakes, rivers, and streams. So we've done some good things. It's amazing to see contractors that used to have a different thought about what piles of dirt and sand meant. Now they're protecting them when we're coming up to a weekend or something. So there's been some good work, Madam Chair, and I appreciate your bringing this issue up.
Okay, you know, I won't talk much about the slide simply because we covered some of these data points already, but this just gives you an idea of what we think we're able to prevent through our stormwater permitting program. Again, these are our best estimates based upon information from the EPA and from the industry. I think as the years move on, we'll get a better handle on this and have a better understanding of how effective the program is. The key one, the key bullet that I want to talk about just a sec is the last one. The stormwater permits that we issue for construction projects do include permanent structures that need to be put in place, and as a result of those requirements, there are ongoing stormwater reduction activities that go on for many, many years, and this is our estimate of how much we've been able to implement in the life of the program. Animal waste management, this is our feedlot program. We haven't seen any change in this program in the last couple of years. It's reached a fairly stable point in terms of how we manage the industry and work together with them to make sure that feedlot runoff is minimized. We issue 1,000 permits, but probably most of the regulatory activity, I would say, happens at the county level. We have about 30,000 feedlots that are registered throughout the state, and those are primarily overseen by the counties who have delegated authority to run this program, and we provide funding to them to do that. We think that as the TMDL program continues to mature, that we will have a better handle on targeting the problem feedlots that are contributing to impairments, and that will allow us to hone in on the areas of the state that we need to provide more attention to rather than having a scattershot approach. Now, as far as our non-point source activities are concerned, this is largely our grants programs, and the slide talks about CWP and 319. CWP refers to the Clean Water Partnership Program, which is a state-funded program. 319 refers to the federal non-point source grants program, much of which is passed through to local units of government to implement non-point source improvement projects. This is a chart that shows you our estimates based upon some pretty reliable models as to the environmental improvements and the outcomes we've been able to achieve through these programs over the years. And I think the most notable one is the phosphorus reduction estimates on the right-hand side of the graph, which gives me some comfort that we're making some good progress. A lot of work needs to be done in this area, but we are making progress, and the key thing for us is to make sure that we maintain a high level of accountability in this area. Now, briefly, before I talk about the governor's recommendation for the Clean Water Legacy Act in the next biennium, just like to talk about what we've done in the last year as a result of the one-time funding that was appropriated by the legislature for fiscal year 07. We were appropriated $1.86 million in monitoring and assessment. What that allowed us to do was to enhance our current assessment efforts. We have increased the number of watershed monitoring sites from 25 to 40. But just to give you sort of a broad overview, we traditionally have spent about $1 million in this area. So the additional $1.86 million is a significant increase for us. We've also been able to increase the level of our citizen volunteer involvement in doing watershed monitoring, which gives us a much better, broader data set so we can understand what's happening across the state with regard to water quality. On TMDL development, we have funded 10 additional projects with the $3.17 million that has been appropriated to us. We, as of a couple months ago, we had dedicated all these dollars to activities in the fiscal year. We were very, very aggressive in making sure that we got staff on board, and then we got the dollars out to the local partners that are doing these TMDL projects. Now on to the Clean Water Legacy Initiative, and I'm just going to talk about the PCA's portion of the governor's recommendation. And it's really, it really falls into two areas, and they're the two areas that I just discussed in the previous slide. What the governor is recommending is that we appropriate $8.71 million per year into TMDL development, which will allow us to do an additional 20 TMDLs per year through the life of this funding. This is a very, very key area for us because it's very, very, I think, incumbent upon us at the agency to make sure that we get these projects underway. Some of them can take several years to get completed, and for us to be able to understand where we need to direct our restoration dollars in the future, these TMDL studies need to be done, and they need to be technically sound. On the water quality assessment piece, what we're recommending is that we continue the increase that we received in fiscal year 07 to the tune of $1.86 million per year, and this will allow us to maintain those 25 additional watershed sites and will also allow us to continue to ramp up our biological assessment program, which is very, very key for our assessment program. This slide I'll just spend 10 seconds on. It's just to give you an overall view of how this activity has ramped up in recent years. The two bar charts on the right that are shaded, those represent what we think we will do assuming the governor's recommendation is passed. That's the number of TMDLs that we anticipate being able to do in the next 2 years. Now I'd like to move into the multimedia budget, which is, it's kind of a catch-all budget area that we use to house our some activities that are funded across the agency. Multimedia refers to things that touch the air, water, and land media together. It's also a place where we have our federal grants programs housed, most of our federal grants programs. The federal grant program is the largest slice of this programmatic area, and that's what we call our Performance Partnership Grants Program. It's akin to a block grant. The federal government, and in this case it's the EPA, decides how much they want to appropriate to us in our specific programmatic areas in the land, air, and water quality programs. They then give us those dollars as a, in effect, as a block grant, which we then allocate to our priorities in agreement with the USEPA. We do have a contract with them to spend those dollars.
With regard to those dollars, since one of our big issues out here is straight line pipes or septic systems that are imminent threats to public health, can you allocate some of those dollars to that program, to grants specifically targeted at dealing with that issue?
Madam Chair, the Performance Partnership Grant for Water Quality is probably the smallest portion of the water quality grants that we get from the EPA, because most of those dollars come in through our 319 program. I don't know whether we can use that program to fund septic system improvements.
I didn't mean that we necessarily use it to give to individuals to improve, but to give to counties to help them do the technical assistance, or to give to you to do the technical assistance to help them get going.
Madam Chair, I would say we'll have to get back to you on that question. I'm not precisely sure.
If you would.
Yep. Okay. On to the org chart again. As I just described, multimedia refers to work that we do all across the agency. Therefore, as you see in the org chart, it appears everywhere. I'm going to talk about a few major activities that we fund out of our multimedia programmatic area. And it's not by all means everything, but I think it will give you a sense of the type of work that we fund in this area. The first one I want to talk about is mercury reduction. This is where we fund our mercury reduction efforts. Now, the slide that you see before you is what we believe some of the recent changes in law are going to bring us in terms of mercury reduction. We have staff that are working actively to achieve this goal, and to also work on implementing the mercury TMDL, which we submitted to EPA late last year. As you can see, there are significant mercury reductions that have taken place already, mostly in the product area. There are reductions that are going to take place as a result of the legislation that was passed last year, but that's not going to get us as far as we need to go. Our TMDL tells us that we need to get the mercury emissions in the state down to about 800 pounds per year to be able to reach the goals that we've set out in the mercury TMDL. And it's a long-term goal, and it's quite a bit more aggressive than what you see on this chart.
Just let me ask a question here. When you were doing some of your work in schools, apparently you found that there was mercury in some of the floorings in some of our high schools. What has been the outcome of that finding?
Madam Chair, that is well beyond my area of knowledge. We could bring Kathy Moger up here to speak to that, if you'd like.
Well, let's just check. Apparently, it was reported to the health department that there was this finding, and I just would like to know some of the outcomes of that. And you can write it and give it to us in writing.
We will do that. This next slide talks about one aspect of our standard setting. Madam Chair, you'd asked about what we're doing in the standards area and when was the last time that we revised the standards, and we will get that information to you. What this pie chart does is it tells you the story of what we're trying to do in our latest standards revision, which we are currently in the process of doing. This pie chart represents what phosphorus loading looks like in the state as a result of a study that we did several years ago that was mandated by the legislature. It was a very, very comprehensive study that was completed in 2004, and it gives us a very good understanding of what's happening with phosphorus in the state. Now, as I said, we are in the process of revising our standard to bring the allowed emissions of phosphorus from wastewater treatment plants down. The two slices that you see at the top of the pie chart represent the point source loading to the environment. If the standards are promulgated as we have proposed, we estimate that that would be cut in about half. Now, that's just based upon what the standard requires in general. I would like to add that as we implement TMDLs, there will be wastewater treatment plants that receive even tighter standards because we will believe that that is what's necessary to get down to the to be able to clean up the impairment. So it's possible that the slice is even going to get smaller from point sources. However, you can tell that quite a bit of work still remains to be done on the nine-point source portion, and that is going to be largely driven through the TMDL process and through the restoration dollars that are appropriated as a result of the Clean Water Legacy Act. Environmental review is a small area of activity for us in terms of staffing and dollars, but it's very, very important and key because it's one of the major entry points for citizens to be able to understand in a comprehensive manner what the environmental impacts from a lot of projects are. We do quite a bit of work on controversial projects, and this could be anything from mining facilities to ethanol facilities to transfer stations, solid waste facilities. It's fairly easy for folks to request that environmental assessment worksheets be done by the agency, and it's work that we take very seriously. We do about 30 environmental assessment worksheets per year, and a couple of EISs, environmental impact statements, per year. That varies a little bit. That's purely dependent upon what kinds of projects come our way. Another area that we fund out of this programmatic area is the air emissions risk analysis process, what we call the AERA process. This is very tightly linked to our environmental review and permitting processes. And just quite simply, what this process does is it requires facilities that have the potential to reduce toxic air pollutants in the environment to evaluate those against guidelines that we have developed in conjunction with the Department of Health to make sure that we are assured that the emissions from the facilities that go through this process are not going to be a hazard. What we're going to do in the coming years is do some work to quantify what the results of this process actually are. On an anecdotal basis, we do see facilities that begin the process with proposed emissions that could be quite significantly higher than what they end up with in the end. We've had a couple facilities go through this process recently where the pollutant loading that will be coming out of their pipes at the end of the process is about 50% of what they projected when they started the process. So it's a learning, I think, process for facilities, but it's also an effective tool for us to be able to make sure that we minimize toxic air pollution to the extent that we can. again, I think that we need to do a better job of quantifying the outcomes of this process, and I anticipate that in a couple of years we'll be able to do that. Training and certification, just very briefly, we train and certify many different professionals across the state in several different areas. We do training and certification of wastewater treatment plant operators. Well over 2,000 of those folks receive training from us every year. We also do licensing and registration of folks that work on septic system issues, whether they're designers, installers, inspectors, or pumpers. And finally, we also do training of landfill operators. And all these efforts are really pretty key to make sure that the folks who work in these areas are up to date on the latest technologies and that they're actually operating these facilities in an environmentally effective manner.
Just a moment. Representative Ansel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question and a comment, real brief. Having recently gone through a residential construction nightmare in a rural area, in a sensitive area, on a lake, I have serious questions about the resources and the prioritization involving the agency and the local unit of government, the partnership that absolutely has to exist in order that we can all be confident that the standards are followed, that the training is better than just adequate, that communication is there. My question is then, therefore, do you all have enough resources to get this job done? Because this is, in the real world, getting Joe's septic contracting business to understand what the standards are and what the requirements are so that the public resource can be protected is the goal. And I got to tell you, I don't feel real sure about that. So, do you have enough resources to do this?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a pretty big question. as you know, the PCA has, when you look at the system as a whole, a relatively minor piece of this, as most of this is implemented at the local level. What I can say is that we have increased resources in this area as far as the PCA's activity in recent years, and what that's resulted in is developing better rules, which we think will be clearer and more easy for folks to understand so they know what they have to do and what's expected. We've also taken some more enforcement actions and pulled some licenses of folks that aren't making the grade. I think it's an area that we'll probably need a look at in terms of future resources.
Well, again, just to follow up, this is a critical area where the partnership and the trust between the state agency and the local unit of government has to be solid. My experience is local officials will follow, but they need leadership, and the technical assistance is absolutely critical in this area so that the resource is protected.
Okay. Next area is our administrative support program. I'll be very, very brief on this area. This is basically, it's sort of the fundamental backbone to the agency, and it's typical of what you see in virtually every agency in the state. The key difference for us is the Citizens Board. As I think the committee is well aware, we have a 9-member Citizens Board that is responsible for making most of the critical decisions in the agency, and that's probably the most notable difference in the agency compared to other agencies in the state. This gives you a sense as to how we fund these activities, mostly out of special revenue.
Explain to us what special revenue is.
Madam Chair, I will rely upon my finance manager to describe that to you. He's done it for me a couple of times, and I'm sure he'll do a better job.
Madam Chair, that's the funding mechanism that we use, which again is, as Deputy Commissioner Ruddy said is common to other state agencies, where we charge all parts of the organization to fund our administrative and support level activities. It's the funding is then brought into a 200 fund account, which is labeled special revenue fund, and a number of salaries and support costs are then paid out of that 200 fund account.
Okay. Now, the last slide will be a brief description of some of the more minor budgetary adjustments that are proposed in the governor's budget, and I'll just walk through them one by one. The first one, which we've labeled Funding to Maintain Service in the Air Quality Program, what this is it's an adjustment based upon what we think the anticipated increase in costs associated with this program will be in the next 2 years. A little bit of background. The Federal Clean Air Act requires states to periodically adjust the fees that we collect from our federally regulated facilities to be able to support the activities in that program. State statute also authorizes the agency to make these adjustments on a periodic basis, and it's based on a formula that relies upon the consumer price index. We have asked for these increases in the past. I don't believe we asked for an increase in the previous biennium. And for the next biennium, what we are seeking is an appropriation from the legislature of $259,000 in fiscal year 08 and $526,000 in fiscal year 09. And this is we expect that this would cover the anticipated increase of 2.5% in costs that we see coming our way in this program.
Let me ask a question in relation to that. I saw that, and that is part of, it, as I understood it, that's the federal requirement that folks who ask for ask for permits, pay for the permit. But then I saw a budgetary part of the ethanol and mining money that the governor recommends go to air quality, and I couldn't understand why, if the federal government requires the person who's asking for the permit to pay the full cost, why then we'd be using some of that money, some of the ethanol and mining money, in the air division.
Madam Chair, the simple answer is that the federal requirement relates to the operating permits. So if you recall the discussion that we had on this on the ethanol and mining initiative a few minutes ago, I tried to make a distinction between the operating permit program and fees and construction program and fees. So what the federal law requires is that we collect sufficient revenues to run the operating permits program, which is that's the permit. Once the permit's been issued and we are doing our regular regulatory work to make sure that they're meeting their emissions limits, paying for inspectors to go out and inspect and to reissue operating permits, that's what those fees are for. What the initiative is about trying to find a way to pay for the costs associated with construction permitting, which is a different level of activity. Now, when we do construction permitting, we issue the permit, and those turn into operating permits, and that's when the fees then kick in a couple of years later after we know what they're emitting. So that's the key distinction.
Okay, so there's that distinction in air, but there is not a similar distinction in water. Am I right about that then?
Madam Chair, that's almost entirely correct.
Well, you can tell me where I'm not quite correct.
As I understand it, we charge some wastewater treatment plants fees based upon the amount of flow. So that would be a good analogy to our air quality operating permit fee. We also do charge very small construction application fees for water quality emitters, and that's the construction stormwater fee, and there's also an application fee for any wastewater treatment plant. It's very small. That's the key distinction. It's a little bit different because we don't call our water quality fee an operating fee like we do as air quality fee, but I think that there are a lot of analogies.
I'm wondering if our fiscal analyst gets into that correctly. Probably does. That's good. Okay. That's good. If you want to continue.
Okay. The second is a small increase in funding to the Department of Environmental Health to do the work that we ask them to do to support our remediation program. Currently, we transfer $200,000 to the Department of Health to do these activities, and we're requesting that they be increased $52,000 per year.
Excuse me, there is a question from Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Roddy, can you respond to a question I asked, I think, when you were visiting in my office? It is about coordination with the Department of Health around these issues of environmental health. Was it 2 years ago now where we had legislation to ask you to try to connect the dots between kind of information you have on toxic sites and the kind of environmental health information that they have so we can arrive at some environmental health monitoring is the word you got here. I think that's exactly a good way to talk about it. I haven't heard back from you what you, you know, you sent a letter and actually in the legislation, 2 years ago there was an opposition from your department to doing that kind of connecting the dots of tracking. So what does this do and where are you with that whole issue? Are you going to be, well, just tell me what you can about that first of all.
Madam Chair, Representative, on that request, we are still working on that, and I believe information is coming to you very shortly. I apologize for the delay on that. With regard to these dollars here, it wouldn't be directed to that kind of work. What this is there is work that takes place at the Department of Health as a result of contaminated sites in our remediation program. And for them to be able to do that job, we transfer funds from the remediation fund to support their activities. That activity has increased in recent years because some of the issues that we're seeing, some of the issues related to 3M contamination. Their estimate is that to be able to provide the same level of service to us, they need to increase that appropriation by $52,000 a year. We are actively seeking to do cost recovery for those funds where we can do so. So I think that's an issue that we're going to get a better handle on in coming months and years. But these dollars are to support those basic programmatic support activities for the remediation program.
Madam Chair? Well, I guess my question will be a little more direct then. Do you still oppose connecting the dots? Do you still oppose trying to have connections made between what you have as information in your department about toxic sites and exposures that you know about and health impacts? And one of the ways to talk about it that I shared with you is the whole issue of environmental justice, that we know that there's a disproportionate impact. There's a disproportionate impact of some of these toxic exposures to low-income people and communities of color. And that's what we were trying to get at 2 years ago with a bill that actually passed the House, passed the Senate. It was in a conference committee, and, you know, your lobbyists came and opposed it. So that's 2 years ago. And we had this conversation when you visited my office. I want to know what your position is on that and whether or not you are willing to work with the Department of Health, which is where this funding apparently goes, to do something more than what you just described.
Madam Chair, with regard to a position today on a specific bill, I guess I'm not prepared to do that today. I'd have to look at the language myself. I know that the staff are working on your request, and I think I'll have a better answer probably in the coming days, but I just wouldn't be able to do that at this time.
Madam Chair, this isn't a bill right now. I'm talking about a policy. Mm-hmm. That could be in a bill, and it could be something you could also just start doing. But if we need legislation, we can try again. My question is, you know, what is the agency stand on trying to understand those connections and work with the Department of Health to make those connections?
Madam Chair, you know, as I've indicated, we work in partnership with the Department of Health on health issues as they relate to our programmatic activities. You know, as far as a specific position on that policy, there are probably a lot of underlying issues that I need to understand a little bit better before I can give you that, because I wouldn't want to mislead you on what our agency's position is. So, I think we welcome the continued conversation. Yeah, as we get the additional information from our staff, I think we could have that conversation, but that's probably about as far as I can go at this point.
Madam Chair, just a final question, please. My understanding, and I did see an email that went to a number of community groups about the issue of environmental justice, that your agency was interested in trying to work on that. I'm giving you a chance to brag about it, I guess, or say that you really don't intend to do anything about it. So I guess that's part of my question.
Madam Chair, you know, on that account, I know that we've been increasing the work that we're doing with the environmental justice community. We've had a couple meetings recently. Again, for me to really go beyond that, I wouldn't want to say something that isn't the case or, you know, mislead the committee as far as our activities, but we'd be happy to talk further with you about it.
Thank you.
Do you want to finish up here?
Certainly. Okay. The third area is increased funding for water programs. And what this essentially is, if you recall from the first day We discussed the agency's budget. I talked about how the remediation fund works in concert with the environmental fund. We transfer funds from the environmental fund into the remediation fund based upon how much work we anticipate that needs to be done in the biennium. What this actually represents is transferring fewer dollars into the remediation fund than we have done historically to fund our staffing as a result of what we see as decreased staffing needs in the coming biennium. And the dollar amounts for the next two fiscal years are $440,000 in fiscal year 08 and $370,000 in fiscal year 09. And again, this just would represent we would not transfer those dollars into the remediation fund as we typically have done.
Let me just ask a question on that. You made that proposal before Representative Moe asked you about the site in his district. Would you hold to that figure after making the commitment that that site has got to be revisited now?
Madam Chair, Representatives, if it turns out that we need to increase resources to the remediation program for whatever site, and if it turns out that we, after speaking with EPA, there's a need to revisit our involvement in that site and do more work at the state level, we have the ability to transfer funds from the environmental fund into the remediation fund. We would do that by notifying the legislature that we're going to do that, but we always have the option of doing that. So if it turns out that we've erred in this decision, it's very easily fixable.
Do you have anything else you want to?
On that one, no. The last thing is just it's a compensation adjustment that we're seeing across the board in the general fund for all agencies, and it's a recommendation made by the governor. And for us, what that represents is $88,000 in fiscal year 08 and $177,000 in fiscal year 09, and it's simply to cover the cost of inflation related to compensation of our employees.
I don't see any questions right now. A couple of things I want to do. We have had a quorum, but I do have one more for you. I just want to get the minutes done. We have a quorum, and I would ask Representative Hansen if he would move the minutes of February 20th and 22nd.
I will do so.
Thank you. All those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The minutes are approved. Two more things, members. First of all, a question just for you to bring back. In your environmental assistance program, I know you do grants, but we did not see a list of the grants that you had done in the past 2 years. And if you could just include that, and including how much went out in SCORE, if you could just give us a copy of that as you're responding. And then for members, you're going to get, or you're getting right now, an agenda for a Friday, March 9th meeting. This is not a required meeting of this committee, but I think it might be a meeting that some of you will be interested in. So I just want to call this to your attention. Representative Tingelstad, do you have any comment on this? Or?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you're talking about the part that starts at 2:15 with the data seminar,
mm-hmm.
and that was some real interesting information as we went through the LCCMR process in the fall with a variety of projects that included kind of high-tech mapping. And so I think we're going to see a lot more of this in the future. So I know the LCCMR members thought it would be helpful to have more background on it, and you know, probably all members of the Environment Committee could learn something from that as well.
Representative Hansen. Thank you, Representative Tingelstad.
Madam Chair, there was another set of minutes for February 27th, so I would move approval of those as well.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposition? There is none. We'll note for the record that there was one nay. We won't name names, however. Thank you, members. The minutes are approved. With no further, we do have one further question.
Madam Chairman, you know, in the spirit of bipartisanship, we do have a person who's had a 44th birthday, and he was nice enough to bring us cupcakes. I think it would be appropriate if Frank Moe would lead the singing of Happy Birthday. Representative Hansen.
I appreciate your reminding me that I just But we're also going to say that we have another birthday, too.
Oh, good.
Isn't this your birthday, Jen?
Oh, my gosh.
She's nodding, yes.
We got a double header.
Well, we should do that and ask the those in the audience to join us.
we have yielded to you. We are going to adjourn the meeting for the table.